It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. There's new research on the relationship between genetics and breast cancer. Testing positive for a BRCA mutation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to develop breast cancer. 25% of women who have a BRCA mutation won't get cancer. Yet many women who carry a mutation will still feel pressure to get risk-reducing surgeries, even if the risk is unknown. We'll break down some misconceptions and talk about the latest research. Do you carry a BRCA mutation? What did you do when you found out? Did you see a genetic counselor? Did you feel pressure to get surgery? Are you a man with a BRCA mutation? What was your experience? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Zappello is a freelance writer whose beats are breast cancer, food, and culture. Her article in the Outline is called, I Had a Mastectomy to Lessen My Risk of Breast Cancer. Does New Science Say That Was a Mistake? Suzanne, good morning and welcome to the Morning Show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
We should start out by asking, what are BRCA genes and why are they important?
So BRCA or BRCA genes are something everybody has. There are two genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they are tumor suppressor genes. And so every single person has them, but some people have a mutation of one or both of those genes. And what that means generally with a mutation is that it increases your percentage likelihood of developing breast, ovarian, pancreatic, and melanoma cancers over your lifetime. And in men, it also increases the risk of prostate cancer.
So there's a common misconception that having a BRCA mutation means that you have to get a double mastectomy in order to avoid developing breast cancer. But that's not actually the case, is it? Why not?
No, definitely not. It's entirely based on your personal preference. I think if you test positive for a BRCA mutation, you generally should be speaking with a genetic counselor, and that genetic counselor is going to talk to you about your options. Generally, there are two widely accepted options, surveillance or preventative surgery. So surveillance would mean that you're undergoing either a mammogram or a sonogram or an MRI every 6 months, and otherwise you might opt for a preventative surgery. But no doctor is going to tell you you have to do one thing or another. It also totally depends on your family history. When was the first diagnosis of cancer in your family? Things like that are all taken into consideration when coming up with your treatment plan.
We're talking about the BRCA mutation and what it means and some common misconceptions about it. Do you carry the BRCA or BRCA mutation? And if so, what did you do when you found out? Did you see a genetic counselor? Did you feel pressure to get surgery? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So having the BRCA mutation doesn't mean you can be absolutely sure of your odds of eventually developing cancer. I've had doctors tell me that if you live long enough, you'll get cancer one way or the other. But what do the odds look like if you have the BRCA mutation?
Right. So cancer is a disease of the aging, but when you have a BRCA mutation, it depends on which mutation you have. But the widely accepted percentage that kind of falls in both BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation is about a 75% chance over your lifetime of developing breast cancer. And depending on your 1 or 2 status, a 60 or 50% chance of developing ovarian cancer in your lifetime. The other cancers are less known, also less commonly linked to BRCA, but are known to be linked to BRCA mutations. But the two important ones that doctors focus on, especially with women, of course, are breast and ovarian cancers.
So there are thousands of different variants of these BRCA mutations, but there are three different categories. Within each of the categories, lots and lots of variants. This is really complicated. Could you break this down for us a little bit?
Yeah, it is really complicated, and I only just learned about some of this myself, and I found out about my mutation 3 years ago. But there are three categories. So there are variant of unknown significance, which is a VUS variant, a deleterious or pathogenic variant, and then a benign variant. So deleterious or pathogenic means that obviously your mutation will absolutely increase your risks of developing these cancers. Benign is not going to increase your risk, and variant of unknown significance is sort of leaving you in an unfortunate limbo.
So when a woman finds out she has a BRCA mutation that can't be classified as benign or as cancer-causing, what are her options? What comes next?
The options are pretty similar to somebody who comes up with a pathogenic variant as well. So again, there's a lot of focus on speaking with a genetic counselor. And when you find out that you might have an unknown variant, most doctors and genetic counselors will likely put you more in the surveillance category because they don't want you to do anything that might be totally unnecessary. So you, for instance, the study that just came out in Nature that recategorized some of these BRCA1 mutations found that the unknown variants were actually, many of them were actually benign, so they were recategorized. However, the people who are also in this category, it is entirely up to them what they do. The same with somebody who is in the category like mine where they have a pathogenic mutation. They could get surgery. They could go under surveillance. It's a 100% personal decision.
How does genetic counseling come into play? Why is genetic counseling important?
Well, it's important for two reasons. First, it's important to see a genetic counselor before you take one of these tests. That's both to see if it's necessary to avoid any undue costs on taking a test like this. If you really do not need it, maybe you have no significant cancer history in your family, but also to prepare you for what the results might be, and then when the results come back, what to do with those results. It's nice to know, you know, what you're going to be up against when you get those results and what your options are, to sort of mentally prepare yourself, because even though it isn't a cancer diagnosis, it is still a heavy weight on you learning that you might have a BRCA mutation.
Well, do you think most women who are tested for a BRCA mutation get genetic counseling? I mean, is that normal, and is it accessible to most people?
I think it's becoming more normal and more accessible. There are genetic counselors who are available online. There are centers that will automatically refer you to a genetic counselor when you're going over your family history, whether it's with your primary care physician or an OBGYN, for instance. However, I do know quite a significant number of women who never saw a genetic counselor, myself included, both before testing for the BRCA mutation and after testing positive for it.
We're talking with Suzanne Zupello, a freelance writer who focuses on breast cancer, food, and culture. Her recent article in The Outline is titled, "I Had a Mastectomy to Lessen My Risk of Breast Cancer." Does new science say that was a mistake? We'll continue our conversation, and when we come back, I want to talk about whether or not most women who test positive for BRCA mutations feel pressure to undergo surgery, even if it isn't known whether their particular mutation is benign or not. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. There's new research on the relationship between genetics and breast cancer. Testing positive for a BRCA or BRCA mutation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to develop breast cancer. Do you carry a BRCA mutation? What did you do when you found out? Did you see a genetic counselor? Did you feel pressure to get surgery? If you're a man with a BRCA mutation, what has your experience been like? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org is the email address. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Zappello is a freelance writer who focuses on breast cancer, food, and culture. Her recent article in The Outline is titled, "I Had a Mastectomy to Lessen My Risk of Breast Cancer. Does New Science Say That Was a Mistake?" Suzanne, do you think that women who test positive for BRCA mutations feel pressure to undergo surgery, even if it isn't known whether their particular mutation is benign or not?
I think if they're feeling pressure, then they should be speaking to whether they're already speaking to a genetic counselor or a physician. I think if they're feeling pressured to do one thing or another, they should always get a second opinion, whether you have a significant history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer in your family or not, it's still your decision, and it's a major surgery, whether you have cancer or not as well. Both surgeries to remove your ovaries or your breasts, they're not something to be taken lightly. I personally did not feel pressure. My doctors very clearly laid out the options and said that the decision was entirely mine, and obviously they would support me whichever route I chose.
A company called Myriad Genetics has played a big role in BRCA testing and what we know about these mutations. Can you explain how Myriad has played into all of this?
Yeah, so Myriad owned the patent to the BRCA gene and was the only company testing for the gene for about 22 years. And so while they lost their patent in a Supreme Court case and other companies are now able to test for the gene, they still have 17,000 BRCA gene variants in a silo that no other physician is able to access. And so other researchers have developed ways to test for BRCA mutations, some of them using CRISPR technology, which is a gene editing technology, to essentially create thousands of variations of a BRCA gene. So they're having to redo the work because Myriad owns all of these gene variants and will not share it for public use.
And originally, when they had the patent on the test, it cost $3,000. What does it cost now?
Well, it's still an expensive test, just like any blood work. But when I entered into the test, and I think when most people do, your physician will tell you, depending on your risk of cancer, depending on how necessary your insurance company deems this, that then it'll be covered or not. So somebody in my position, because I had significant family history, my test was covered. There are also other options now for taking a BRCA test, whether it's color or 23andMe. Those are much more affordable options, but they are done via mail. They're not an in-person testing. There's not that face-to-face contact to discuss whether the test is necessary and the counseling after.
We're talking with Suzanne Zappello about the BRCA mutation and what it means these days. New research on the relationship between genetics and breast cancer means that testing positive for this mutation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to develop breast cancer or some other cancer. Wondering, do you carry a BRCA mutation? Share your story with us. What did you do when you found out? Did you see a genetic counselor, for example? Did you feel pressure to get some sort of surgery? Men can also have this mutation. If that's the case and you have it, what was your experience like? Give us a call, share your story with us, and you may have some questions for our guest as well. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Zappello is a freelance writer focusing on breast cancer, food, and culture. She had a recent article in The Outline titled, I Had a Mastectomy to Lessen My Risk of Breast Cancer. Does New Science Say That Was a Mistake? So, Suzanne, Myriad still has proprietary information about BRCA and breast cancer risk. What information do they still have that they won't share?
Like I mentioned, they have 17,000 variants of BRCA mutations that are proprietary that other researchers aren't able to tap into to cross-reference with their own research. However, there are a couple of databases that do share this knowledge publicly. So there's the BRCA Exchange or BRCA Exchange, it's a curated data platform that's in collaboration with other research labs and scientists that can input their research of BRCA mutations and make it known whether they're a variant of unknown significance, benign, or pathogenic. So there are ways that the public can access what their mutation is once they receive that information, and there are platforms for physicians and researchers to access as well to cross-reference their findings.
I understand that the National Institutes for Health ClinVar database, and more recently a study published in Nature, classified an additional 2,000 BRCA mutations as either benign or pathogenic. What do we know about it? I mean, is this something the general public can get at? And if we could, what use would we make of it?
Yeah, so they did make these databases public. The ClinVar database is used in the BRCA Exchange, among other databases that are in there as well. For the public, unless you test for this gene, the database doesn't really do anything for you. You need to know exactly what your variant is to search it on there. But for scientists, it means a lot. It means that they can play around with gene editing and see what these genes mean, test for these unknown variants, which are also listed in the databases, and use it whether they're studying more just about the mutation itself or treatments for cancers related to these genes.
800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Stephanie, who joins us from Madison. Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about a research article I read a few years back out of Switzerland or Sweden that really looked at women's experiences who have the positive BRCA1 or 2 mutations. And it wasn't necessarily looking at pressure from providers about needing to do something, but it was pressure women experienced from families about potentially not going through with a surgery that could prevent, you know, cancer from happening. Like your host said, you know, or like the guest said, these are significant surgeries and they really need to be, you know, carefully thought through, especially, you know, given, you know, new emerging research. And so women really felt, you know, this pressure from families of, well, why wouldn't you do this surgery if this would keep you around longer?
Suzanne, what about what Stephanie has to say here?
Yeah, I think really important to note, especially because a lot of women are undergoing these surgeries at younger ages. For instance, I have friends actually who've tested positive for this gene, and their families have not wanted them to undergo surgery. They found that it was too drastic, and they tried to talk them out of it. I brought my parents to every single doctor's appointment, and at the end of the day, they told me it was my decision. They would support me either way. I think once I decided that I would get a preventative surgery, they were a little relieved, just because when you're told that you have an 87% chance of developing breast cancer in your lifetime, it's more than likely that you're going to develop cancer. And what family member, parents especially, want to see their child or their family go through cancer? But I do think there is a lot of pressure on both sides of that, to undergo surgery or to not undergo surgery at all.
What about the public perception of breast cancer and BRCA and how that's changed since Angelina Jolie's very public surgeries and struggle with cancer? Is this a good thing because of increased awareness, or a bad thing because more people may misunderstand what BRCA mutations are and how they work?
I think there's a little bit of both there. Angelina Jolie being so public about her BRCA mutation has opened the door to a lot of women knowing that there is this test available and considering their family history. But there is also this sense that, you know, this sort of celebrity trend of, now I need to get this test because maybe I have this gene and maybe I need to undergo surgery, without fully knowing that only 10% of breast cancers are linked to BRCA mutations. So that's a very slim group of people that are going to fit in the Angelina Jolie category. And again, I just cannot stress enough how important it is to talk about this with a doctor, with a genetic counselor, before even thinking about taking the test.
Where can we get more information? We've got about 30 seconds left. What's the best place for people to go?
There is an awesome organization at the University of Pennsylvania called the Basser Center. So if you go to basser.org, you'll be able to find a ton of resources there to talk about what a BRCA mutation is and if you should test for it.
Thanks a lot, Suzanne. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much, John.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Suzanne Cipello, freelance writer who focuses on breast cancer, food, and culture. Recent article and outline is called "I Had a Mastectomy to Lessen My Risk of Breast Cancer. Does New Science Say That Was a Mistake?" I'm John Munson. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Sears, once the largest retailer in the U.S., hasn't been profitable for years, has accumulated billions in debt, and has been selling off stores and other assets to compensate. Now it looks like the retailer may decide to file for bankruptcy. We'll talk about why the once mighty retail giant has fallen on such hard times. Do you think this is finally the end for Sears after years of struggling? Are you surprised the company may file for bankruptcy? Do you think retailers that keep open brick-and-mortar stores are fighting a losing battle? And how much of your shopping do you do online, and how has that changed in recent years? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Felicia Miller, chair of the Department of Marketing and an associate professor of marketing at the Marquette University College of Business Administration. Felicia, good morning and welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
After years of struggling, it looks like bankruptcy or liquidation is inevitable for Sears. Felicia, break this down for us. Can you please?
Yes. Sears is one of the oldest retailers in the world. They've been around 125 years, so they've seen a lot of things and had to adapt to a lot of things. But I think the last, 10 to 15 years has been a struggle for them and for a lot of retailers because of the technology that's involved in retail now. The online business has just gone, through the roof, and we're seeing fewer and fewer brick-and-mortar stores. So that's definitely a factor in why Sears is struggling.
Yesterday there was news that the company's lenders were pushing for liquidation rather than reorganizing through bankruptcy. Can you explain what each of these options would look like?
Well, liquidation is essentially selling off any value assets that the brand might have. That includes, property, and Sears does occupy some prime real estate across the country, any merchandise they still have on hand, literally down to the studs. And so it's just essentially selling off for what the debtors can get for those resources. The other path of bankruptcy does have the option of reorganizing the organization, paying down some of the debt, discounting some of the debt, and reemerging as, Sears. That path is probably pretty unlikely given that there doesn't seem to be a willing entity that wants to take on that task, but that's a possibility as well.
In the end, does it really matter whether Sears liquidates or reorganizes?
If the reorganization is successful, then you get, a leaner, more connected, more online-focused brand. but given the debt load that they're carrying, it's unlikely they're going to be able to generate the funding to be able to really recreate this brand. So I think in the end, whether it's reorganizing through bankruptcy or liquidation, I don't think Sears is going to be a brand that's around for much longer.
You mentioned the debt load, and that's something that comes up every time we have a discussion about one of these brick-and-mortar companies that gets into trouble. The finger gets pointed at online retail. Well, the brick-and-mortar just doesn't have any future. But isn't there also a really good argument to be made that if these companies weren't carrying so much debt, through all the acquisitions and mergers they went through, that they would be in a lot better shape to take on the online retailers?
I think that's right. And it's a choice that companies had to make, 15, 20 years ago. There's a handful of retailers who saw the future, and they knew that online was the future, and they invested in creating infrastructures and communicating with their customers through these digital platforms. Other retailers, and Sears is among those, went a different path. They went the merger and acquisition route. They expanded their footprint. They didn't necessarily invest in technology, but instead in more real estate and brick-and-mortar stores. That's a different path, and as it turns out, that wasn't the right path for most retailers. We've seen that with Toys R Us. We've seen it with Boston stores, companies that just, frankly, didn't invest wisely in what the future of retail was going to be.
And they did it with borrowed money. I mean, this wasn't cash they were putting out. They were borrowing the money in order to expand.
Exactly, yeah. And in some cases, in the case of Sears, there's been a lot of funds that the CEO has put into the business to kind of keep it afloat, because he has a very successful career in finance and is able to do that. But most debtors are not as willing to cooperate other than to perhaps finance a liquidation.
We're talking about Sears and its future, and wondering what you think. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking with Felicia Miller, Chair of the Department of Marketing and an Associate Professor of Marketing at the Marquette University College of Business Administration. We have some callers. Mackenzie is on the line from Whitewater. Mackenzie, hello.
Hi. Yeah, so I am a mom of four kids. I work full-time. My husband works full-time. And we don't have time to go shopping in general. And these stores, like, some of the basic things I would want to buy, like snow boots for my kids, they're $30, $40, $50. But if I go to the marketplace on Facebook, I can find them for $2, $3, $5, $10. I mean, it's just, you can find things so much easier and so much cheaper, even if it's used online. And if you want something brand new, you can still sometimes find it at a fraction of a cost in these gigantic stores. I mean, it's almost like you're selling yourself short by shopping at these stores at the end of the day. I can find Under Armour. I can find Columbia things. I can find all the top name brands or top name utilities on different places on the internet, or just in my hometown from other people who are selling their stuff.
All right, Mackenzie, thanks for that call. Felicia Miller?
Mackenzie's exactly right. One of the benefits of having a digital platform, either through a store website or some other marketplace like Amazon, you can compare prices very easy. It's very transparent, the same item at different price points. The other option that she mentioned is, there's been lots of local opportunities for people to exchange items they no longer need to get other ones. We see this emerging as well as sort of a local version of these market exchanges, which, again, have the transparency so you know exactly what you're paying for and you can figure out what the low-cost options for you are. The other piece that Mackenzie sort of touched on is, stores are not stocking as much merchandise as they used to. The inventory levels are very low because they're driving people to online. So you may go to a brick-and-mortar store looking for something, and it's simply not available.
Sears, as you mentioned, Sears CEO Eddie Lampert with his hedge fund ESL Investments have been very active keeping Sears afloat. But, you know, how they managed to stay open for so many years, I mean, they haven't been profitable since 2010. Why keep a company running in debt for so long?
I think part of it is the fact that Sears has long-term contracts. The brand has been around 125 years. They have very long-term contracts with the various malls that they anchor. And frankly, they're paying a very low cost per square foot for that space. If you were to, you know, Sears goes away and you bring in another anchor store, you could triple, quadruple the amount of cost per foot that you could sell to this new retailer. So they have that longevity on their side, and so they're, you know, relatively speaking, their operating costs are low as it relates to the physical spaces where the stores are.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Sears appears right on the precipice of bankruptcy, or if their creditors have their way, liquidation. This brand could be going away. We've seen it happen in Wisconsin with other stores when Bon-Ton went under, and we lost Boston and Yonkers and a bunch of other stores. And if you look at malls around the state, there's some big empty spaces where there used to be thriving retail outlets, and we're kind of wondering why. I want to know what you have to say about this. 800-642-1234. Felicia Miller is with us for this hour as we kind of talk through this. Let's take a call next from John, who joins us from Brown Deer. John, good morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for answering my call. And I'd like to ask your guest two questions. One, would you surmise that Sears would also liquidate their Kenmore appliance outlet stores, such as the one that's located on Highway 100 in Wauwatosa? And secondly, perhaps someone could suggest that they reconsider keeping smaller stores open, like a specialty hardware store, just to sell their appliances and their tool line, because they had very good tools. Yeah.
John, our guest needs to be able to respond, and we're getting close to a break. Felicia, let's take that first part first. Is some part of Sears going to survive this?
It is. In fact, Sears has sold off a number of its very strong brands, Kenmore, Craftsman, and some others, because individually those brands have a lot of value.
All right. There are some local Sears stores that are not owned by Sears, and you see those in some of the malls as well, and that could be what John's talking about there with the second part of his question. We'll continue our conversation about the demise of Sears in just a little bit. Felicia Miller is with us, and we'll take your questions and calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think? You do most of your shopping online these days? What about brick-and-mortar stores? Do you think they have a future? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Sears, once the largest retailer in the United States, hasn't been profitable in years, has accumulated billions in debt, and has been selling off stores and other assets to compensate. Now it looks as though the retailer may file for bankruptcy or simply be liquidated. Does it surprise you that Sears may be going under? How much of your shopping do you do in brick-and-mortar stores? How much online? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Felicia Miller is chair of the Department of Marketing and an associate professor of marketing at the Marquette University College of Business Administration. We have Tracy joining us by phone from Madison. Tracy, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the Morning Show.
Good morning. So I have a question. So much emphasis is being put on the effects of online shopping to some of these major retailers. However, Target is a brand that's completely thriving both online and within their stores. Our Target is always packed. People are there all the time, and my kids actually are starting to consider it a destination more so than the mall, for instance. Target is the place they want to go. So I'm curious as to what it is that Target did differently. What is the Target model that some of these major department stores haven't seemed to be able to figure out?
Tracy, thanks for that question. Felicia, what does Target do that other retailers aren't doing?
Well, I would say there's probably a handful of retailers who've kind of gotten it right. Target is certainly one of them. Walmart as well. Macy's is getting there. Kohl's is getting there. And what all these retailers have in common is they have found the right balance between brick and mortar and online. So for those stores, you have the option to buy online, but they also provide a good in-store experience, particularly Target, with the number of designer brands and variety of products that they offer that will also draw consumers to their store. Right now, you know, brick and mortar is still the predominant source of purchases for consumer goods, with online growing. So it's important to make sure that store experience is there, that brick and mortar store experience is there. But for the percentage of consumers who prefer online, they're going to be satisfied as well. Having that foresight to make the investment in the infrastructure to provide both in a very high-quality way is something that a lot of companies, including in Sears, Kmart, and others, just weren't able to do.
Hey, the irony here is that Sears started out as a mail-order house. I mean, they made their money on their catalog. I mean, that's how they, you know, that was the basis of their business. And then they went a different direction and kind of forgot about how they started. Had they, I guess it's kind of pointless to speculate, but had they maybe taken that and said, okay, let's put the catalog online, we wouldn't be having this conversation?
I think that's a fair assumption. I think the other big challenge that Sears faced as, you know, they moved from decade to decade, they had a very broad assortment of products. You think about, you know, Walmart today, well, Sears was that, you know, 2, 3, 4 times, because you could buy everything from tires to towels to lawnmowers to, you know, literally anything that you would need to buy, you could get it.
You could buy a house. You could buy a house.
Yeah. I remember that. And so, you know, carrying that level of diversity of products is incredibly expensive and over time becomes very inefficient to manage. And so that, I think, also had a big part of why the brand has not been successful. Just trying to maintain that type of model is really difficult and really expensive.
Well, some people point the finger at Eddie Lampert, who's a hedge fund loaned billions to Sears and Kmart to keep the companies going, but didn't invest enough in e-commerce and updating the brick-and-mortar stores, particularly compared to what other competitors like JCPenney, Kohl's, and Best Buy were doing. What's your take on that? Is this his fault?
I think that there was certainly the money there, particularly earlier on when we started to see the rise in online. I think that the question is, where do you put that money? And, you know, I obviously don't, you know his full background, but not having that retail experience or, you know, having people leading the company that, you know, have that sort of brick-and-mortar retail experience could easily, you know, lead to making choices that don't ultimately wind up allowing the company to be successful. But with that said, you know, Sears is not the only one. You know, there are a lot of companies who bet on brick and mortar and other companies who bet on online. And the real solution is sort of a mix, a hybrid, where you offer both, depending on what consumers' shopping habits are. And that's really the winning combination.
So, Felicia Miller, the idea here is fish where the fish are, I think. Let's go to Deborah.
Fish where the fish are going, yeah.
Where the fish, right. You got to figure out where the fish are going and then put your bait in the water there. Good idea. Deborah in Madison is next. Deborah, go ahead.
Well, I was just wanting to say that I think there is a future for brick-and-mortar stores if they had stronger customer service, which is something e-retail cannot provide. But I've had a couple of experiences where I have returned an item at a store or had a question about it, or it didn't work, and they don't care. They take the thing back, they give me my money, and I never get to say anything.
All right. Deborah, thanks for the call. Felicia?
One of the benefits of brick and mortar is certainly getting that personal contact and interaction with a service provider. Unfortunately, those experiences in many companies are not positive. And I think earlier Tracy was talking about Target. Target provides excellent customer service by and large. That's an important part of their brick-and-mortar experience. You see people, you know, throughout the store, you know, asking if you need help, providing you with assistance in finding things. But that's also a very expensive proposition to have very well-trained employees. But when it's done right, it can certainly be a reason why a shopper would choose to come to the brick-and-mortar store as opposed to shopping online. And that's definitely been a standout for companies like Target.
Thanks for that call. If Sears does end up liquidating, and it looks like that's likely, what happens next? And who are the winners and losers going to be in that situation?
Well, you know, as was the case with Bon-Ton and the Boston stores and others, it's going to be, you know, a huge issue for all of those employees. I mean, the company has scaled down dramatically. I think they're down to less than 400 stores or so, but that's still a lot of people who are going to be impacted. The other folks that are going to be negatively impacted are those who, for them, Sears is their only option that's convenient for them to shop. So those consumers will be looking for, you know, other places to go and buy things if they want the brick-and-mortar experience. I mentioned earlier the really low rent that Sears has been paying as an anchor store in a lot of malls, and I think some malls will welcome the closing of Sears because they'll be able to bring in a more profitable tenant that may fit better with the type of stores that they have in that mall. So some of those mall owners may be actually looking forward to having the opportunity to bring in, you know, a new offering for their customers.
Let's take a quick call from Joe in Waukesha. Let's see, we can get Joe on the air here real quickly. Joe, go ahead. Yeah, we're almost out of time.
Yeah, the issue is malls. I think we've built far, far too many of them. Sears generally is attached to malls, as is Boston stores, whereas you have independent, like Walmart, separate stores. People go, it's much easier going into a Walmart, everything's in one entity, and we have far, far too many malls.
Got it. Joe, thank you. Felicia, do we just have too many malls?
The consumer demand for malls is definitely going down. The retail cycle is trending toward more what Joe said, you know, standalone stores or more neighborhood shopping where you have multiple stores all in a convenient location that you can just drive up to what you want. That's definitely where the brick-and-mortar part of retail is going.
Okay. Felicia Miller, Chair of the Department of Marketing and Associate Professor of Marketing at Marquette University's College of Business and Administration. Thank you, Felicia. Appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call debate for the first time tonight at 7:30. WPR brings you the debate live. Ahead of that debate, join us for a special that looks at the Wisconsin candidates for Senate. That airs tonight at 7, followed by the debate. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.